welcome to another episode of Sacred Cinema here on 2XX 98.3 FM, People Powered Radio. I am your host, Jimmy Bernasconi, for the next half hour, and this week's episode is entitled Realizing the Fantasy. A very, very special episode of Sacred Cinema that we have for you today. Usually, the fans of the show would know that we chat about three films, sometimes a few more, and sort of go bang, bang, bang between them, sort of look at a point maybe one film might make if we want to peel away certain insights from it, and then have a look at maybe an alternate view that another film has, and then try and synthesize or reconcile those views with a third film. Usually, that's kind of the structure of this show. It's a Sacred Cinema first this week, partly because it's a Sacred Cinema last, in the sense that I will be going on a few weeks hiatus coming up, as I am about to travel overseas for quite some time. Obviously, the show will go on. I hope that's clear. But there will be a couple of weeks of hiatus of Sacred Cinema, and I thought to sort of cap off this season, let's say, we're going to do my favorite film of all time. I've armed and ahed, tiptoed around chatting about this film on the show before. I've mentioned it briefly here and there. It comes up a lot. It covers a lot of thematic ground, but we're actually going to dedicate an entire episode to my favorite movie, which is, as I've said on the show a couple of times, La La Land, directed by Damien Chazelle. I'm not ashamed to say it. I know it's not everybody's favorite film. It's one of those kinds of films, a bit like this show, really. You either love it or you hate it a little bit. And I'm very excited to talk about it. And it's very apt because tomorrow I will be actually flying off to Los Angeles, actually, in a matter of, it's about 7 hours away that I'll be going off there. So I'm looking forward to that. So I think it's very apt. And I was very much in the mood to watch it, knowing that I was going there. And I've just got so many thoughts on it. I'm not sure we're going to be able to cover everything in half an hour. So much to this film that we're not going to get to. But we're going to particularly focus on its exploration of fantasy in opposition to reality, let's say. But not just fantasy and reality, but like sort of idealism, utopianism, dreaming. Looking optimistically at the world versus sort of the realistic or pessimistic sort of slap in the face you get from the everyday. The fact that, you know, don't dream too big. Things are actually, you know, like this, and life isn't that perfect, and it's actually quite difficult, and we need to take these things into consideration. We can't just, you know, willy-nilly say that we want this, this, and that. Things aren't that simple. We're going to try and to reconcile some of those differences and see what the film says about that tension, that inherent tension between kind of dreaming or fantasizing and realistic expectations. So without any realistic realities, I suppose, and not expectations. But let's get started now. You know, with the film this week, La La Land, from 2016, directed by Mr. Damien Chazelle. So let's firstly talk about how the film explores this idea of fantasy, or better put, how it explores the human tendency or our propensity to dream, to think big, to think that our life is worth more than it currently is, and that we could be doing something more interesting, doing something more exhilarating, that puts us maybe in the center of everyone's lives because we're doing something significant. Well, I think part of it is the title, obviously, the play on words, La La Land, obviously, L.A., L.A., Los Angeles, Los Angeles. Land is the term given to it, but La La Land has a connotation of being, you know, a fantastical place, off with the Pixies, even in a game of rugby when someone gets knocked out and they're kind of delusional. And concussed, that people often say that the person's in La La Land or Gaga Land. So we obviously have that from the get-go. But just on a basic level, and I think it's apt to sort of talk about, if you haven't seen the film, you know, just the general synopsis. Our two protagonists are one's Emma Stone plays an actor, and Ryan Gosling plays a burgeoning sort of jazz pianist. And they both have very big dreams of being famous and you know, making it, let's say, in Los Angeles and in the world of creative endeavors and that sort of thing. So we have that sort of archetypal the archetypal sort of story of the person trying to make it. But this film's happening on a lot of levels. It's happening on sort of the artistic level, you know, the ambitions that a person has sort of in terms of going about their life and being creative and doing, you know, creative work, but being also, you know, just sort of setting a goal and reaching it on a sort of a little individual level. The film is also a romantic film, though, not in the sense that it romanticizes, which we're going to sort of talk about a little bit more, romanticizes Los Angeles and life and all those sorts of things, but it is romantic in a romantic sense, in that it explores the concept of love, and both of these characters do fall in love, and they have to, and it's a gushy kind of film, and it makes you feel warm in the stomach when they hold hands and they look at each other a certain way. And so we actually, as an audience member, have an experience of romance and fantasizing when we watch the film. We think about, you know, what would it have been like to be with Emma Stone or Ryan Gosling, depending on your particular persuasions. Let's say, and then I think adding to that, you know, this theme of romanticizing is the fact that it's a musical. It's otherworldly. It's not a strictly realist film. They jump into song and dance during the film. We know that we're in the world of we're not in reality. We're in a kind of different kind of a world that resembles the world where people have arms and legs and things like that, and they stand on their feet and they wear clothes, but they jump around and sing and dance in the streets, which is not something that people do in the everyday. Although in places like Los Angeles, some people do that sort of funny thing. And speaking of Los Angeles and the funny kinds of people that live there, I think we're talking about things on sort of a surface level at the moment. What this film sort of does, which takes it to the next level, is it does a very good job. And when it first came out, it was a big hit for how it was able to romanticize not only just life in Los Angeles, but the mundane elements of living in a place like Los Angeles, the kind of gross or undesirable or the kind of underbelly aspects of Los Angeles. Namely, the opening scene is so iconic because it is able to romanticize something that is so unromantic, i.e. sitting in a hot car in the middle of traffic on the freeway there. So it's able to take, you know, it's able to show. We talk about this a lot on the show, but why, you know, the further down a road you go, you know, the more you steel man something. If you're able to paint that thing in a different light, that goes to show just how, you know, how great the propensity is for human beings to sort of fall into that category, fall into that world. And we would say that about this as well. It's not just that they romanticize, going on a paddle boat over a lake. The fact that human beings can romanticize something as unromantic as traffic speaks to the degree to which we're able to romanticize as an act. Our capacity for romanticizing is bigger than just romanticizing traditional ideas, romantic ideas, but we can romanticize things that aren't traditionally romantic. That's how much we like to romanticize things. That's how much we like to turn things into a fantasy and things like that. And I think also, like, you know, it's funny watching this film as someone who's, I mean, I was in Los Angeles last year and I've been there a couple of times, but I remember when I first saw this film, I hadn't been there for a while, and I don't think you actually can fully get the impact of the film unless you've actually been there and kind of recently, and you kind of, when you see the scenes and where it's shot, and like you kind of know where those places are, and you kind of remember how you felt, like, kind of in your gut when you're in those places, and you're kind of like, that's not a fun, nice place. It's kind of a gross place. Like, I don't remember feeling romantic there. It adds an extra layer to it, extra punch. The fact that they were able to make some of these places look beautiful and not smelly and gross, which a lot of parts of LA are, is particularly interesting. So I think, you know, a lot of people from overseas living here, you know, in Canberra or Sydney or in Australia, or, you know, kind of only see Los Angeles through the lens of Hollywood films, and kind of looks like a kind of idyllic, kind of cool place. It's a grungy, kind of gross, smelly place for the most part if you haven't been there. So, you know, it's not just the traffic scene, but the whole endeavor of the film to romanticize a city such as LA. And obviously it has its inner beauty, and that's what's expressed by the film. But you need an artist to be able to do that, and that's what the film's doing. But I want to expand these things out to a sort of a broader, dare I say, more important or significant, to make a sort of broader or more significant point here, that this film is not just about romanticizing one's life or one's journey or one's relationship or one's setting, one's home or one's residence, but also romanticizing kind of like the future of humanity, kind of on like a broader socio-political level. So the point I want to make here is particularly captured in that scene where Sebastian and Mia have just caught up in the lot, and they're walking around looking at all the sets and everything like that. And Emma Stone's character, Mia, is talking about sort of her last audition was some kind of cringy role for some teenage show that she doesn't really have much of an interest in. And Ryan Gosling's character says, Seb says something like, you got to sort of make, you're more than an artist. You got to put your stories out into the world. You got to be sort of the engine, the core, the origin of your stories. And he aligns her journey to that of Louis Armstrong. And this is where I think it's apt to sort of say, well, part of the reason I do love this film is, and fans of the show would know that I have a deep love, a lifelong love of jazz. And so I do love how the film explores jazz, and there's lots of references to different jazz musicians and all the imagery of the jazz stuff. And then I just love the Seb character and everything like that, and what he says about what Louis Armstrong achieved and who Louis Armstrong was. And if you're not familiar with Louis Armstrong and what he did for not just jazz, but I guess you could say 20th century Western music, pretty much from when he emerged in sort of the 1920s, I suppose you'd say, is that he completely reinvented sort of how music was done in terms of the way he improvised. I mean, there was sort of degrees of improvisation when people, and this is sort of not spoken, said in the film, but I think it's relevant. He kind of invented the idea of improvising in the way that we know it now, and sort of treating melody the way that we do now, like putting on top of, you have a chord progression and inventing not just sort of small iterations or, little ornamentations on top of the core melody, but actually exploring sort of the full harmonic, the depths of pushing the parameters out in terms of what can be explored, and it still sound like music, and it still sound good, and actually sound better every time you sort of reinvent it through your improvisation. And that's kind of the way in which music has kind of been approached ever since. I know not everybody improvises in every song that it's, and this is kind of a reduction, it's not a very general view, but the idea of having sort of a set chord progression, feeling like we can sort of invent something over the top of that, and also do it, with other people, that we can get into what you might call a jam session. These sort of original ideas that came from the beginnings of jazz through people like Louis Armstrong, etc. It's kind of like the archetypal. It's a very archetypal creative innovation. So it's not simply just a story about how we like to romanticize our individual lives and our romantic lives, but how we like to romanticize the future of human beings. How can we change our cultural practices, our cultural norms even? How can we change our culture so it looks different, feels different, but feels also better and enhances our lives as a result of when we do that? So we get into a much broader territory here, and that's something we're going to follow through after the remainder of today's episode. Before we do, just remind you are listening to Sacred Cinema here on 2XX 98.3 FM People Powered Radio. I'm your host, Jimmy Bernasconi, for the remainder of this half hour. We're chatting the film La La Land, directed by Damien Chazelle, this week, in this week's episode, Realizing the Fantasy. But be tuned, please stay tuned for more quality radio programming here on 2XX after Sacred Cinema. And also jump onto our website to consider subscribing to the station or sponsoring the show. All that would be very much appreciated. But moving on now, we've talked about how we have this propensity to fantasize, to dream on many different levels. But what the film also does really well is it reminds us that reality and sort of the slap in the face that we get from the grittiness of reality, the kind of soberness or the bluntness of reality, is kind of inevitable on all those different levels that we've been talking about, be it the personal, the romantic, the interpersonal. I mean, you say romantic or interpersonal is kind of the same thing, or sort of the broader sort of socio-political, socio-cultural levels. So I think if we're talking about, like, how the film conveys life not being completely romantic, the first point I want to make, and I kind of picked up this, I mean, I've seen this film so many times, but I picked up just upon a recent rewatch, is the little jokes and bits of dialogue that are kind of, they're almost Tarantino-esque in their kind of how they have that sort of street level, kind of very relatable. It doesn't have that Laurence Olivier, like, because a lot of this, I shouldn't say Olivier, but like if you think about how sort of flamboyant and performative the golden age of musicals and cinema was through sort of the 40s and 50s and early 60s kind of thing, that a lot of the films inspired by a lot of those films of those era of that era, they don't have that kind of street level day to day talk. It's very performative. It's enormous, like sort of theatrical, because musical theaters and Broadway and that sort of thing is a huge influence on how films were made. But this film does sort of have moments of kind of realistic dialogue, if I can say that, if that makes sense. Like, for example, like, just on a basic level, like the Emma Stone being frustrated about the parking meter. Like, you would never think you'd just see a parking meter on Broadway or the West End or something like that. And it's sort of it's literally a street level kind of gag. But also, her fetching coffee and having a little tray of coffee, and she works in a coffee shop, and this is sort of the gluten-free gag, which is kind of like a bit meme level. But we're seeing this iconography of the everyday. We're seeing sort of plastic cups and half-eaten croissants. There's a nice way to say that, Karen. Like, we have glimpses of seeing people speak to each other in the way that we would see, and it's kind of almost like a relatable bonehead kind of comedy kind of movie. And also, just going back to, probably the best example of this is going back to after the opening number, when we have romanticized traffic and we fall in love with traffic, we come back down again. And you kind of feel sort of, there's a sense of casting, just looking at these people roasting in these cars on the freeway there. So, it does sort of, when it needs to, sort of sink back into the real world, that kind of disgusting, gross real world that we do live through. But if we're going to talk about how the film does slap us in the face with this sense of reality again, we can't look past, the dinner scene where Chazelle very conspicuously changes the way that the film looks from being this bright coloured, cinemascope looking flashback to like golden age cinema to a much more gritty 21st century realist drama. And I can't help but think, especially with the casting of Ryan Gosling, that the way he shoots that scene with the Steadicam and the walking around and just the color of that scene, it is kind of like it does have a very blue Valentine-ness to it, not only in the look, but obviously because you have these two couples, one of which is Ryan Gosling, fighting about how the relationship is going and sitting over a table and doing it in that way. Like, you, if you put those scenes next to each other, and I'm sure I'm not the first person to say this, but it does, I almost think that is almost a conspicuous throw to the blue Valentine moment, and the songs stop, and then it becomes much of a realist film. But again, let's broaden things out again to sort of the more socio-political or socio-cultural, I should say, sort of elements here. It's not just a question of, just because you have your dreams as an individual, as an actor, that it doesn't always work out and you have to go back to Colorado or whatever, wherever she's from, or, just because you have dreams of marrying someone and it doesn't really work out, that's territory that's been trodden time and time again. There's explorations in this film about the tension between having this kind of revolutionary perspective, particularly in the artistic realm, as we mentioned before, with like the Louis Armstrong reference and trying to innovate and revolutionize music. But traditionalism kind of having this inevitable, this haunting of us. Every time we sort of reach for revolution, we kind of end up weirdly going back to the traditional by accident sometimes, or it's kind of waiting in the shadows and jumping out, or Trojan horsing its way back into the situation. And obviously that's depicted in just that line of dialogue that John Legend's character says to Sebastian, when he says, how can you be a revolutionary when you're such a traditionalist? Because obviously Seb is obsessed with trying to keep jazz alive. So this is almost like a traditional kind of almost conservative kind of approach to making sure that, jazz doesn't die, that jazz stays, bringing jazz back and making sure it's kind of pure. Like, there's almost this kind of like obsession with purity. There's almost this quasi kind of neoconservative kind of like, we've got to, if we've got to keep jazz, we're going to keep it pure the way it's meant to be. We can't have a change and that sort of thing. And so despite the fact that he wants to be the next Charlie Parker or be the next Louis Armstrong and has a great deal of respect for guys like Louis Armstrong and in the way that he sort of projects that onto Mia, he himself actually, in valuing those ideals, has found himself to be engaging in this kind of traditional you know, engaging back with the traditional. And that's not to say that that's a bad thing, because when he does sort of do the new thing, does do the new kind of modern contemporary jazz, or what the film tries to show is sort of modern contemporary jazz, it doesn't feel right as an audience member. We feel he's betrayed his values, and we feel that that's something he should have done. You know, he should have been a little bit more conservative. He should have stayed closer to his roots. And that's, you know, it's not necessarily a bad thing that we might want to revert back to reality or revert back to the traditional. But it is nevertheless in tension with, you know, this sort of value that we have for revolution, for the ideal. And to broaden things out again and get things a little bit more meta here, like sort of taken to a different sort of dimension a little bit, the film itself is hindered, one could say, or restrained or constrained by reality. And there are flaws to the film, and there are moments that in the making of the film that we as audience members pick up on, and we see the limits of the film itself as sort of evidence for how inevitable reality, how inevitable realism, and dare I say pessimism, can sort of again seep its way into creative and revolutionary endeavors that purport to be or intend to be revolutionary in a sense. So, I mean, just on a basic level, like with a musical. You know, when there's the changes in the quality of the sound and how they're, you know, we can hear them talking and then the quality of their voices changes when they've clearly been singing and it's been edited and things like that. And also when the film came out, people came out and were like, oh, you know, Gosling and Stone, they can't really sing. They're not traditional singers. They should have got proper singers to do this film. And also, like, you know, the criticism of the film around, like, sort of the lack of African-American actors and things like that for a film about jazz and stuff like that. Like, there is no limit to how many flaws you could point out about the film insofar as it is a film, and films are flawed. And despite the fact that they sort of get us going and make us a little bit, excited and they sort of lift up the chemistry in our brains, we can't help but think, you know, we are just people watching this film in a room, it's not being made by some kind of deity or god or something like that. So should we just not watch films? I mean, if we know that there's sort of this kind of obsession with fantasy is maybe a little bit of a fantasy. It's like fantasies are a fantasy, right? Like we know they're not necessarily realistic, they're not attainable. Should we just not engage in fantasy? Should we just sort of stick with the status quo, stick with the reality, understand that, you know, things, you know, that we're going to sort of inevitably want to revert back to the traditional? Well, I think the film not only to sort of finish off that, I don't think that the film not only does it promote, you know, sticking to your guns and chasing your dreams in terms of what happens to with the actual characters, but the film itself walks the walk. The film itself embodies the ideals that it goes on to promote in the sort of the characterization of the character arc. So obviously our characters do achieve their goals by the end of the film. But so does the film. The film also achieves its goals, despite its flaws that we've named before, and then the endless list that you could continue to list. We still get an emotional impact by the end of the film. If you go onto YouTube and you look up the, you know, La La Land last scene, you'll see lots of people commenting like, this scene is crazy, you know, it's my favorite scene of all time, da 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 da. So despite the flaws of the film still works. And I think part of that is because part of the, like, at least this aspect of the film is enhanced when you start to think about the fact that it's a film that's made by actual people, right? And it's a film about actual people achieving their goals. Like the actual, you know, the plot of the film, the narrative of the film, even though it's a fictitious film, is about people who resemble real people, who are flawed, who aren't perfect, who aren't, you know, romantic, becoming romantic, becoming falling in love, but also becoming successful and becoming more than what they were prior to that. And the fact that that is made by people who are also like that sort of speaks to how true this sort of this theme is. And I don't want to say that the film is non-fiction, but there is sort of like a meta-modern thing happening. The fact that this is made by actual people, I guess you could say that it gets to a point where the flaws of the film, you know, the moments of the film when we're reminded by this is made by actual mere mortal people, paradoxically don't actually hinder the film, don't constrain the film, but actually kind of, it actually enhances the film. We kind of have this moment, like the fact that flawed people can still get this result, the fact that they can still make me feel the way I'm feeling, despite the fact that they're not perfect and how they go about doing that. It sort of reminds us that the glory that we see when we look out upon a city like Los Angeles, and we see sort of the sheer prestige and the power and the riches and the fame that these people are able to obtain, it's important that we make sure that we remember that those are actual real people. They were just like us once upon a time, and they just did a certain amount of things to get to that place. That's not something that we can deny. Things have this gloss of looking fantastical, otherworldly. We talk about this a lot. Years ago now, we did an episode on Hollywood. We talked about the film Under the Silver Lake, set in LA, and talking about we sometimes endow or project onto people, cultural elites, this image or this facade of being, greater than mere mortals. We've got to remember that, this is actually something that, despite this effect that might feel that we're transcending ourselves in the everyday and feeling totally motivated, remember that that is sourced. The fuel of that comes from pure human, I don't even want to say ingenuity, just human effort, really. So let's try and bring these three ideas that we've been talking about today together. When we talked about, at the start of today's episode, we talked about the fact that human beings have this kind of propensity to dream. We like it. It's a nice feeling to sort of let that fuel sort of burn and churn inside us. When we have the big dreams ahead of us, and not just on a personal level in terms of our goals, but also we like the idea of thinking that we might meet someone. We like the idea of thinking that we might fall in love, or if we're already with someone, that it might turn into something great, that we might get married and have babies, and it makes us feel warm inside. It's a very nice feeling. We like watching movies where that happens, and we like to put ourselves in those positions. I like to think that one day we'll be in those positions ourselves. But on the flip side of that, we can't ignore the fact that reality always bears its face. It does come around the corner at some point. And sometimes when pursuing fantasy, that's just the moment we actually realize that at the pursuit of our ambitions, the pursuit of our goals could actually be the pursuit of something that's actually already happened. It's the pursuit of something that lies in our past, and that's not necessarily a bad thing. Conservative or value for the traditional is not in and of itself a bad thing all the time. It's a traditional norm to sort of love one another, to treat each other with kindness. That's been something that's a fairly traditional ideal throughout human history, but you wouldn't say that it's a bad thing purely because it's conservative. So even it's a weird thing to even say that out loud. And we see that even in this Seb character himself. Like, we're happy that he's able to give new life to Jazz, and we kind of think that he's betraying his values when he goes and does this new kind of this Jazz. But these two ideas don't fit in together well. Right? We have to way to put it is that we have to sort of maintain our ambition and our romance and this sort of sense of having a vision, despite the fact that we know that those things are going to be almost attacked or subject to or influenced by reality and the truths of the sort of the gritty truths of existence. So perhaps the goal is not to actually dichotomize fantasy and reality, or to dichotomize romance and reality, or sort of having strict ambition and also feelings for another person that might hold us back in doing that, right? Maybe those things can actually, maybe they don't always go together, but we can remember that, one of those things influenced or helped the other thing along the way at some point, right? Seeing that reality is actually part of fantasy. So, because it might be, if you think about it, it might kind of be scary and arduous to think that the road ahead, might look like something that's sort of riddled with tensions and sort of contradictions. But someone will walk that road, right? An actual human being will walk that road, and that person will be flawed insofar as they're a human being, and human beings are flawed. And so it's not so much a question of, can we do it, but who will be the one who does do it. So perhaps when we look out upon a city of stars, let's say, maybe we shouldn't just look for those and the things that sparkle, but also look out for the things that don't. Well, that's all we've got time for this week on Sacred Cinema here on 2XX 98.3 FM People Powered Radio. Thanks so much for tuning in again, and we'll be seeing you in just a couple of weeks after a brief hiatus. But thanks so much for tuning in. Cheers.